Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll talk about what's going on these days with the airline industry. And certainly, like so many industries, airlines are struggling in the continuing economic downturn. Last year, all of the major airlines except one, all of the major U.S. carriers, I should say, except one, lost money. And it is now projected that this year the world's airlines might indeed lose as much as $9 billion. Now, certainly the airlines are doing better than, oh, say, the auto companies. No, none of the airlines is in bankruptcy right at the moment, but people who watch the industry say, you know, it's possible that could change, particularly as the number of flyers, people flying, goes down, and people downgrade from first class and business to coach. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the present and the future of the airline industry, and our guest is David Grossman. He writes the Business Traveler column for USA Today, and someone who has had a lot of experience working in and watching the industry. He worked for 11 years in the airline industry, where he helped to implement the consumer online reservations system that millions of people now use. He served as Director of Electronic Commerce for U.S. Airways, where he managed the airline's website. He also worked for Galileo International. That's a global computerized reservation system that thousands of travel agencies use to book travel for their customers. He now, of course, as I said, writes for USA Today. His writing has appeared in other places as well, including the Boston Herald. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, if you want to join the conversation, you just pick up the telephone and call us. Well, the only thing we ask of people who are calling in is just that people are brief, so we can keep things moving along. But anybody who'd like to call and join in can do that. Mr. Grossman, hello.
Hi, David. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, it's really I'm sure that it's sobering here for people in the business to look at some of these numbers. Apparently, earlier in the year, it was estimated, and I think these are numbers that come from the International Air Transport Association. They were saying this year maybe the world's airlines, oh, maybe they're going to lose close to $5 billion. Now they're talking about $9 billion, and we're not even at mid-year yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty grim. In fact, the number that you gave, the International Air Transport Association, just revised that number to $9 billion, and of that, they said that $1 billion will be the amount that the U.S. airlines will lose. Well, the U.S. airlines lost $2 billion in the first quarter, so, and things don't look like they're going to pick up much, so I think it's going to be even worse than what they're saying right
yeah.
now. Business travel, travel in general has dropped off quite a bit, business travel even more so. But after 9/11, we had a 7% drop in travel demand, and now with the global recession going on, that has increased. It's a 15% drop. So we've never been in such uncharted territory before, where things the demand has just gone so bad, and you know, business travel beyond that has dropped even more than you know perhaps I don't know two or three times the amount of business travelers are not traveling versus leisure travelers right now.
So it's not just that I'm sure that it's also happened that business travelers before, if their companies could, they were flying business class, and I suppose there are people that actually can. I can't imagine how many people, but people actually can afford to pay the first class fees. So it's not just that people are downgrading and people are going from there to coach. It's just that it's that people aren't going at all.
Yeah, it's both. It's both, David. A lot of corporations have changed their travel policies. Whether or not this is permanent, we don't know. But certainly in this global economy, they don't want to be spending the money. They don't want to be seen like they're spending frivolous money, sending people in international business class or first class. And so basically that premium traffic, which the airlines depend on so much, it's such a high proportion of their revenue, that premium traffic has dropped off considerably, and that's really messing up the economics of the airlines tremendously. Even if they're able to fill the flights with, you know, people buying $200 tickets in coach to go someplace, and they, you know, have great sales, they still need those people in the front. They need the business travelers that usually pay full fare and that that fly in business class and first class, and they're not getting them.
Yeah. You earlier, just a moment ago, made a reference to the tough situation the airlines faced right after 9/11, and certainly it was a very difficult period, and there were several bankruptcies at that point. Delta, United, Northwest, they all went through bankruptcy. U.S. Airways went twice. And so I suppose that some people are saying, well, if they ask this question, how are airlines doing now? What's the possibility, again, something like this might happen? They say, no, they went through this really rough period after 9/11. They did a number of things, and so maybe they're in better shape now than they would have been had they not had to go through that difficult time. Yet the question still comes, what do you think are the possibility that we might again see sometime in the next year, maybe, see somebody, a major carrier, file for Chapter 11?
Right. Well, I think it's possible. The airlines did lower their costs quite a bit, those that went through bankruptcy. Even those that didn't go through bankruptcy went. They basically were, doing anything they could to lower their costs and got concessions from unions and so forth. So they have lowered their costs. That's helped them against the low-cost airlines like Southwest and JetBlue and AirTran, the upstarts that have come in basically and are have with much lower cost and, you know, are expanding rapidly. So right now there's still a differential. It's still a little bit, you know, I would say probably the average major airline, their cost per seat mile is 11 cents, whereas the low-cost airlines are 10 cents a mile. So they're not quite at par yet, and I don't know whether they will be. It's hard to do that if you fly globally and you've got, you know, five or six different kinds of aircraft. So they're better off than they were, but they're still losing a lot of money, and that's really due not to the to the low-cost airlines these days. It's due to the economy. Now, on the other hand, you know, we've had a couple of years of profits, not great profits, but the industry did recover a bit in 2006-2007. So the airlines, the major airlines, have had a chance to shore up their balance sheets to some degree, and most of the majors have a couple of billion dollars in cash, so that can sustain them if this thing only lasts a year and a half. But if we are in a prolonged recession, which hopefully we're not, but nobody really knows here, if it goes beyond that, then I think we could see some of the majors filing for bankruptcy again.
Well, then I was interested in your reaction to some comments by Richard Branson. He got some attention. I suppose anything he does will get attention, but he certainly got some attention when not long ago he said that he wasn't really sure that all of the big U.S. carriers would actually be able to survive over the next year. He said, I don't think the American government will yet again put more billions into the airline industry. They've learned their lessons from the car industry. He said, quote, I just happen to think it's unlikely that all the big American carriers will survive the next 12 to 18 months. And apparently he thought there were two, at least two, that were problematic. He didn't say which. Do you think that it's that bad?
At this point, I don't think so. I think that, as I say, I think that all the, all five of the majors that I exclude Southwest because they're sort of they're major, but they're more of a low cost airline still. But the five legacy or network airlines, United, U.S. Airways, Delta, Continental, and now Delta, which includes Northwest, who did I leave out? Somebody there. Continental, yeah. So there's five of them left.
Yeah.
They all do have enough cash right now to sustain them for a while. Now, if things get worse, if there are more shocks to the system that we can't see and the global economy gets worse or there's other things that come along, like, if this pandemic thing ends up being as bad as it's been predicted sometimes, and we see the kind of global shutoff and travel that happened in Mexico in the past couple of months, then all bets are off. Yes, they could lose that money, virtually overnight. But the other thing is that the U.S. airlines have been, this is because of the, in some ways, the oil shock that we went through last year kind of put them in a track where they were reducing their capacity. Most of the U.S. airlines have reduced about 10% to 15% of domestic capacity, and that's helped them to some degree, and they will continue to reduce capacity as long as they can. I mean, right now, as long as the as we're not getting the kind of yields that they want, the kind of traffic that they need to make money, they continually are dropping dropping flights, dropping routes, and you know they all made announcements last week that they're dropping another 1 or 2%. Excuse me. So that will continue if we see you know this situation sustained. So I don't think it's that imminent at this point. But, you know, again, a shock, an unseen shock to the system could change that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to wonder about the possibility of further consolidation. You talked about the fact that Delta absorbed Northwest, and I guess that over time there have been fewer, there are fewer and fewer, and there continues to be speculation about potential combinations of various of the legacy carriers. Is there anything that you think that there is particularly likely there, or I suppose again it just sort of depends on how things go?
Yeah, Dave, I don't see anything immediately happening. Of course, I you know could be wrong, but I think that right now everybody's in survival mode, and you know the Delta Northwest things happened when times were better, and actually, you know when airlines are more it's when times are better that they consider these types of options. I mean, so after the recovery, which I'm sure there will be a recovery, there could well be and may well be more mergers. But right now, I don't see it happening. But again, I guess if we get to the point where somebody is ready to close their doors, which again I don't see it right away, but if this happens for a while, continues for a while, then somebody could decide to fold up, not necessarily even that airline, but just cherry pick their assets that they want, the routes and the hubs and those types of things that would be of interest to them. But I wanted to mention one other thing, and that's that I'm not sure whether the government would bail out the airlines again if they get into that situation, and if it's throwing good money after bad, certainly. But there's a lot of other shareholders, a lot of other stakeholders that cannot afford to see the airlines or any of the major airlines disappear. Number one are the banks, particularly the banks that have affinity credit cards with each of the airlines, like Chase with United, American Express with Delta, Citicorp with American Airlines. They have such a huge portion of their credit card holders, a huge business tied up in the mileage programs that they can't afford to see their airline disappear. And so when we did have the situation back after 9/11, Citicorp and Chase and particularly American Express floated money to their respective airlines to keep them afloat. You have other stakeholders, the airframe manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus can't afford to have all those airplanes go back to sitting idle on the market so that they can't sell new airplanes. You've got the engine manufacturers. There's a lot of stakeholders that really stand to lose, and even municipalities like Chicago could not stand to see American or United or Southwest go down. They all have major hubs there, Dallas with American, Houston, Continental. So there's, the cities themselves also are major stakeholders, and I think between all of these, it would be very difficult for an airline might go back into bankruptcy. They might shrink a lot. They may change their business plan, their business structure. But as far as disappearing altogether, I don't see that happening very easily at all in this environment.
Our guest is David Grossman. He writes the Business Traveler column for USA Today. We're talking about what's going on these days in the airline industry. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You just mentioned in passing Southwest a little while ago, and this was one American carrier, one American airline that actually made money last year. Everybody else lost money except them. And I maybe you can raise a question about whether you consider them to be a major or not. But I guess my question is, well, what is it that Southwest is doing right? And is there something about the way that they're positioned that just is an advantage for them? And that's why it is that they can be in the black when everybody else is in the red.
Right, right. Well, yeah, Southwest is unique in a lot of ways. And in fact, you mentioned that they made money last year. They made money for 69 consecutive quarters up until the middle of last year. And they've actually lost money for the first time in many, many years. They lost money for three consecutive quarters. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why they lost money, particularly in these three quarters, is one of the reasons why they were so strong for so many years while everybody else was hurting, and that's that they had the cash, the foresight and the cash to hedge, to buy hedges on oil prices, so that last year when oil prices hit $150 a barrel, Southwest was still paying $50 a barrel for their fuel, a third of the cost of the others, and they were able to make money. They were able to control the pricing and keep the pricing down to the point where they could make money and others could not. They played their cards right, and there was some luck and there was some skill in that, but they got caught short. Nobody expected oil to drop as quickly as it did, and so they are actually losing money. And I think they lost $91 million in the past quarter, and something like $70 million of that was due to the oil hedges that they still have that they're trying to unwind and get rid of right now. Although, again, if oil goes up again, all the airlines are going to want to be hedged. So that has helped them a lot. But, yeah, intrinsically, in terms of Southwest, their structure is different than the other five network carriers. Southwest, first of all, they were a low-cost carrier. Their costs have come up. They're still, sort of in the, I think they're in the 10-cent range. They're still below what the five network airlines are paying. But their cost structure has come up. But what Southwest has done, basically, over the years, they've kept a very simple business plan. They have one class of service. They've got one type of aircraft, the 737, across their fleet. That keeps their costs down. They've cherry-picked the routes over the years that they want rather than trying to maintain a hub-and-spoke network. They've moved into places where there have been, opportune times and have basically grown their business very carefully by picking off those places one by one. Now, their costs are coming up, too, because they're sort of running out of places to go without going into large markets now. So most of their expansion is into large markets. They just announced that they're going into Boston and LaGuardia and Milwaukee. They recently went into, in the last few years, Denver and Minneapolis. So their costs are coming up there, but they still have a unique business model, and they're keeping to it. They're not trying to be more than they need to be, basically. So they may make money, but again, they're hurting too with the drop off in premium travel at this point as well.
All right. We have a caller here in Piatone. Let's talk with them on our line four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. You're talking about Southwest a little bit. I got an interesting thing. I had to go back and forth out to California a couple of times in the last couple of months because of family problems, family illnesses, and death. And I tried to get on Southwest, and living close to O'Hare, to me, it's far quicker for me to go to O'Hare from where I live in Geneva, Illinois, than it is for me to go to Midway. And I was willing to drive the distance to go to Midway, but the problem is they were $100 more to go to LAX than they were for American or United. And I know a lot of people like to fly it, but I've never found a decent fare yet to go to the Southwest, to go to places like Colorado Springs or something, unless you're taking off from an airport like in Milwaukee or, Bloomington or someplace like that. So I'm kind of miffed at how they're making money because to me I think the up cost is a 25% more charge than what you get on other carriers. The other thing is the airlines are kind of like the car manufacturers. I firmly believe that they bought way too many planes and they did a lot of stuff they should not to. Of course, we all did that when the economy was growing here a couple of years ago. And I'll bring this up because if you go out in California again, in Mojave Airport, there's dozens of planes from different air carriers out there just sitting there, almost like brand new. In fact, I think there's a couple of brand new ones out there sitting there because they can't afford to fly them. And so I don't feel sorry for the airlines, and I happen to know two of my neighbors who work for a couple of major airlines, and they're getting ripped off in their pensions and ripped off. They're basically giving everything away except for the company just so they can keep the company afloat. And I wish they'd file Chapter 11 and do what the auto manufacturer should have done in the first place, you know, and get rid of the excess money because it's their own darn undoing. And I can't feel sorry for them. And I want to, I was wondering what your comment would be on that, and I'll get off. Thank you very much.
Wow. Well, yeah, interesting points. Let me go back to the first one about Southwest. The caller actually has discovered something that a lot of people have not discovered, and that's that Southwest is not a low-fare carrier anymore. The other airlines have learned how to match Southwest fares, and in many cases, he's absolutely right. Southwest does not have the lowest fares often, and I find this as well. Southwest sticks to, you know, they stick to their guns. They basically have their yield management program, and they, you know, they have their sales as well. But as I say, they're no longer the low fare carrier. There are a lot of people around who love Southwest who are very loyal customers. And Southwest sells most of their tickets on their website, which is one of their, you know, it's one of their weapons. It's one of their, you know, one of the ways that they differentiate themselves. And a lot of people think of Southwest as being a low discount carrier now, and they will go to Southwest website and buy the ticket without even looking to see what, you know, United or American or whoever is doing. And it may well be that those other airlines are undercutting them. So that's absolutely true. And Southwest has not had a load factor that's any higher than any of the others. They're all about, you know, 70% or so. And again, the reason why they're making money is because their cost structure is still a little bit lower than the other airlines. So, but you know, absolutely, they're still a low cost airline to some degree, but they're not a discount airline in that way. To address the other part of the question about letting the airlines go into bankruptcy, absolutely. I concur. It would reduce the capacity, and caller is absolutely right that the deserts are stocked with airplanes as they were after 9/11 when everybody parked airplanes. Once again, Mojave and the, you know, the other places where they Victorville where they parked the airplanes are full of airplanes, you know, the airlines are trying to shed capacity to try to match, you know, the demand that's out there. And yes, if somebody does go bankrupt and goes into Chapter 11, they're going to emerge much smaller, and it will park a number of airplanes for some time. It's a good solution in terms of the health of the industry overall, but it will mean higher fares for consumers. Possibly in the short term, definitely in the long run with fewer competitors.
Well, you know, it was sort of my impression that airlines have already done what the caller was talking about. They have switched to smaller planes. They've eliminated some routes. They have cut the number of flights. They've cut jobs. Is there more room to cut?
Yeah, not a lot in terms of, basically without cutting more routes, The airlines are pretty lean. I mean, they basically and they have the caller made some some mention of the way employees have been treated. It's not been a good situation for a lot of airline employees. They've had a lot of things taken away from them in their jobs and are working under suboptimal conditions in a lot of cases. So, no, there's not a lot of fat to cut. I mean, the airlines are looking for anything possibly that they can cut, and they're looking for any revenue that they can generate, which is why we have all these fees now for bags and checking or upgrading to a better seat and all these other things that the airlines are buying food and so forth. So they're looking for any way that they desperately can to either increase revenue or save costs, but there's not a lot, basically, other than dropping routes that are not as profitable as other routes.
We are at our midpoint here. We have two callers we'll get right to. Before I do that, let me first of all just once again repeat that there is possibility of some severe weather in our area for today. And in fact, a little while ago, the Storm Prediction Center issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of central Illinois that will be in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon. And in our severe weather coverage area, these counties are included: DeWitt, Ford, Livingston, Logan, and McLean. So once again, they are included in a much larger area that is under a severe thunderstorm watch until 4 o'clock this afternoon. There is possibility of some storms developing again this afternoon, and we'll keep you informed what's going on in the weather. Next comprehensive look at the weather will be at about 12:35 as part of the afternoon magazine. Mike Sola is in the weather office this morning, and he will tell you what he knows about what's going to happen this afternoon. And, of course, you keep tuned here to AM 580, and we will do our best to keep you informed of any severe weather that comes into the area. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Grossman. He writes for USA Today. He writes the Business Traveler column. He's somebody who was involved in the airline industry for a number of years. He worked on the consumer online reservation system that a lot of people use now. He was director of electronic commerce for US Airways, where he managed their website. He also worked for Galileo International. That's a global computerized reservation system that thousands of travel agencies use to book travel for their customers. Before that, he also worked in electronic publishing for Rand McNally, and the publisher of Who's Who in America. And we're talking this morning here about the airline industry. Questions are welcome, and we have several lined up. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll take the calls in the order they came in here. We'll start with line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Was it, or is it true that prior to the deregulation of the airline industry back in the, I think it was the early 80s, right, the airlines were profitable?
That's, you ask a question?
Yeah.
They were, if they weren't, they were propped up by the government. They were, essentially the airlines were, they had certain routes that they could fly. Most of them were monopoly routes, there were certain routes that they had to fly, and if they were losing money on them, the government would subsidize them. So, yes, they were profitable.
Yeah, well, what I'm about to say is sort of a philosophical question. It's disturbed me ever since that the airline industry, like many other industries, has since been on a race to the bottom, and therefore is somewhat suspect in some areas, particularly, say, safety. That sort of thing. I often wonder, okay, if these guys are fighting tooth and nail for every nickel, what are they giving up in maintenance and so on and so forth? That's one problem. The other is, of course, is that it seems as if airline flight, which used to be considered a luxury, at least when I was a wee lad, it was considered a luxury. It wasn't considered a necessity. It seems to be in the mind of the average American these days a sort of a birthright, like, you know, big cars and 50 cent a gallon gasoline and so forth. And I don't think that's quite the reality, or it doesn't need to be. And as an example, in order to keep the price of everything as low as possible, you know, it's cut this, cut that, and cut everything else. And I've thought to myself from time to time, I wonder how all the people on those airplanes that crashed into buildings on September the 11th, 2001 would feel if, say, there was an additional $25 or $50 fee on their ticket so that we had armed air marshals on our airplanes and you know, have prevented the events of that day, if they would have been willing to buck up the extra money or willing to, you know, accept the fate that they did. So I guess the gist of where I'm trying to go with this is that I really would prefer that, as a nation, we shifted our, if we could, shift the way the airline industry works so that it is, in fact, a luxury instead of a necessity, because it's also not exactly the most environmentally friendly way to move people from point A to point B, and make it the safest most reliable way to go someplace, but, you know, of course, at a price, a price that truly reflects those needs and necessities and so forth. You know, people well, pilots and crews well trained, planes well maintained, security on the aircraft, and whatever it costs, and if it has to cost more than, you know, $50 more to make it profitable and safe, or $100 more for a flight, so be it. Respond to that any way you want. I was sort of rambling there, but tell me what you think.
Sure. Let's see, a couple of different points, I guess. And, yeah, I think before deregulation, the airline industry, or, you know, flying was a luxury. Many people, you know, it was beyond the scope of many people to fly, and it was sort of, you know, it was something that just sort of the elite did. And deregulation changed all that, and people did get off the couch, and flying has become, you know, something for the masses now. There have been those that have called for re-regulation again, hoping that will basically, you know, shore up the industry and you know, improve the service and go back to a time perhaps when fewer people are flying. You know, you can debate the merits of that. I mean, it would have some value in terms of reducing the, you know, the greenhouse gases. It would have some value in reducing congestion and so forth. You know, it's sort of hard to put the genie back in the bottle at this point. It's gotten to this point. It sort of does go against the American principle in some way to say we're going to re-regulate and not just let, you know, competition rule here. So, but yes, it would have those effects that you mentioned there. Could change it back the way it was. In terms of safety, I have to beg to differ. I think that the industry is very, very safe, particularly the mechanical part. The, you know, the airplanes keep getting better and better, more and more reliable. We learn lessons as we go forward. Up until this this spate of you know, these recent episodes, the Colgan Air flight that crashed in Buffalo, and the Air France flight off the coast of Brazil, there hadn't been a major disaster in a couple of years. I mean, it's, you know, air travel is the safest part of your journey of any other kind of travel out there. Statistically, you're far more likely to get injured or killed in an automobile accident or some other mode of travel rather than air. So I think that I do think that there, and there are strict standards, of course, you know, things happen here and there, but I think that the safety is very important to these airlines. It's very costly to them. You know, if you look at it crudely from that standpoint, it's very costly to them to have a mishap like what's happened. Not only does it cost them in terms of lawsuits and everything else, but, you know, the people avoid them basically, and it hurts their reputation. One of the things I think that, as far as there's always pilot error, there's always those types of things that can happen. Although we do have a very well trained, group of pilots, but it is pointing to the fact in the commuter air flight that crashed in Buffalo that that pilot had not passed tests and so forth, and that's an issue that it's another issue, I guess, that needs to be looked at more carefully. And in some ways, I'm just sort of speculating here myself, but you know, we went through a period where things had expanded so much that there was actually a pilot shortage, and that a lot of the pilots who were flying those smaller airplanes had a lot less experience than they had in previous years. So now we're sort of at the point where, you know, there's been so much capacity cut that pilots are out there looking, experienced pilots are out there looking for jobs more often. But it could have been a contribution or a contributing factor to that crash. But I think the system is pretty safe, and it takes an awful lot of things to go wrong at the same time to produce an accident with fatalities in that way.
All right, let's talk with another caller here. Line two, Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, a moment ago, the host mentioned that airlines were economizing, and he mentioned using smaller airplanes like the Embraer 40-seat jets that fly in and out of Champaign here. My understanding is that's actually a more expensive way to go when you measure per passenger mile, which is the key. In fact, AirTran tried that and ultimately rejected those 40-seater planes and did a very careful financial analysis that a 737 or larger plane is really more economical per passenger mile. I'd like the guest to comment on that. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct in a lot of cases. I mean, if you're, you know, I mean, it's not correct if you, you know, if you only have a 40 people flying on that plane, and that's all that you can serve in that marketplace, and you're flying it with a 150-seat plane. But certainly, in a cost per seat mile per person, larger aircraft are more economical. And the interesting thing is, yes, there was a huge rush towards the regional jets back sort of after 9/11 when the industry started to recover again. Everybody was trying to buy regional jets to be able to cut their costs in terms of serving, you know, be able to or improve service, basically, have more flights, and to serve more places, you know, and sort of downsize the airplanes to match demand in that way. But actually what happened last year when we had the $150 a barrel oil was suddenly those small airplanes became very unprofitable to fly. And so the airlines began to take away. It was more efficient to fly 100-seat airplane rather than 250-seat airplanes on that route. So to some degree, the small airplanes, those sort of under 70 seats, have become more of a liability and are, you know, there isn't the same interest in them that there was before. And that will increase again when oil prices creep up again.
If I could follow up a little bit, isn't the punchline here that you don't serve markets like Champagne? You do what Southwest does, which is you say, what routes can I fill a 737, which seats 200 or 225, I don't remember the number. Isn't that the more profitable model?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's why Southwest has made money. As I say, they've cherry-picked the routes that make sense for their fleet, and they haven't gone, you know, they haven't gone off the mark in that way. The airlines that have these large hubs, I mean, it has a cost to it. Basically, you have to have a certain number of flights coming in to fill all those airplanes, and so you do need to send out a lot of airplanes into smaller communities, and then you need to try to find airplanes that can match the demand. But yes, it's far more costly for somebody flying in one of those smaller planes where there's only 30 or 40 people per passenger than on a much larger plane that's full, basically. So, and I think the big airlines are beginning to realize this to some degree, that they have cut back service to a lot of small communities. 87 small communities lost all air service last year during the oil crunch, and a lot of the really small communities have lost a tremendous proportion of their air service because it's just not profitable. But then on the other hand, the flip side of that is, again, if you cut back too much, you can't fill the airplanes that you've got, you know, that you need to fill the large airplanes that are in the hub. And so it's kind of a very delicate balancing game, and it's very difficult when you've got so many different types of aircraft out there trying to serve so many different markets.
Okay. Well, let's Great. Go on to line number three. This is another caller in Champaign. Hello.
In terms of cost-benefit ratio, in the 50s, a lot of federal money was put into roads and airlines. At the moment, it would seem that the railroads are doing pretty well. They might have a dip for the present economy, but basically they can send a ton of freight 400 miles on a gallon of gas. So they're fairly energy, there's an energy economy there. Do you think that at the moment, if the federal government were to put more money into subsidizing railroads, that's if the railroads wanted it, would that be better than to try and prop up some failing airline industry?
Right, it's a good question. I've been a big proponent of high-speed rail. I know there's a lot of people that don't think it'll work, but I think if done right, it can work. It's worked in Europe and other places, and I personally, if we had a very good high-speed rail system for, you know, again, not to take somebody clear across country, not to take the person going from Chicago to Seattle, but the person going from Chicago to St. Louis or Minneapolis, under 500 miles, I think that those, you know, we could have a system that would get a lot of cars off the road, and there's no reason why we would have to have flights that that are less than 500 miles. Rail systems came into air terminals the way they do in Europe, so that you could transfer seamlessly between rail and air, and if they had the proper stations with the proper parking spaces so people could drive to the station or places to rent cars at the rail stations, there's no reason why somebody wants to spend 5 hours from the time they leave their house in Chicago to the time that they get their hotel in St. Louis, going through the air system and dealing with all the hassles and everything. They could get there by rail a lot faster. So I think it's something we should be doing. We've spent a lot of money on infrastructure in the highways. We've spent a lot of money on infrastructure for the airports and the air system. And I think it would be well worth the country investing in high-speed rail and also do a lot of good for the environment.
They're already, the freight lines are dropping the number of semis that are going interstate because they're more efficient in terms of energy.
Yeah, well, freight has definitely, you know, the railroads have survived on freight, and it is the most efficient way to move certain types of bulk material, for short or long distances. And also that they've worked out a very nice system with the trucking companies for intermodal freight, so that you can have containers that travel by rail and end up, you know, going the rest of their destination by truck. So, yeah, absolutely, that works. But I think for passenger, you really need a totally separate system that really can't. You really don't want to have freight running on the same rails and so forth. And freight does travel a lot slower. So it really would have to be a totally different system, but
thank you.
I think it could work.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Grossman, and he writes the Business Traveler column for USA Today. We're talking about the current events in the air industry. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I just want to go back to something. I think it sort of connects with you'd mentioned a little bit earlier the air crash near Buffalo, the Colgan air crash in February, and there being some questions raised there about pilot training, the level of experience, also pilot fatigue. I was really amazed in reading about that story to read that the two people who flew that plane, I think one of them lived in Florida and the other lived in Seattle, and they were flying out of, was it Newark?
Yeah. Yes.
And that so here the one woman who lived in Seattle had to get up. I don't know what time she had to get up and fly all the way across the country to then get on the plane that she was going to fly. And you know, it seems that there are a lot of people, at least there are people who were doing that, people who really wanted to be pilots, who were taking these jobs. They didn't pay very well. They lived far away from home. They were exhausted most of the time. And that this is a real, now we're pointing to this being a serious problem. And I wonder whether it's likely to get to be a bigger problem as the major carriers, maybe they shrink services. Well, it's these regional carriers. They now operate something like half of all the commercial flights in the country. They've picked some of that up. So is the volume of flights for the regional carriers and the volume of traffic on them going to go up? And are we going to start to see more problems?
Well, yeah, it's interesting, David. The volume of regional carriers flying has gone up tremendously over the last decade. I mean, they have taken over many of the routes that the big guys didn't want to fly anymore because it wasn't profitable for them. And so basically, that's how the regional airlines respond, and they have grown tremendously. But, you know, in terms of are they going to grow more, I don't know. It really depends on it depends on a lot on the price of oil and the demand that's out there. If they can run a business successfully, some of the regional airlines have done very well, pairing themselves with flying under the name of Continental or United or whoever. basically, and they have a business model that works that way, where they're paid by the major airline to fly those routes, and they don't have to maintain their own, many of their own systems, like their reservation system and other central computer systems and so forth, so they can concentrate just on flying those aircraft. I don't know that we'll see a lot more of that happening, and it may shrink again if there's, you know, again, if when oil prices go back up, because it'll be less profitable. But definitely, if you look at the statistics, the smaller jets, the regional jets, have had a higher instance of crashes per million people than the larger jets. Why that is, they're subject to possibly a lot of different speculation. One, you know, could be definitely that pilots who fly the smaller airplanes are less experienced. It can be that the smaller planes may not have as much sophisticated the guidance systems as the larger planes. But still, it's very, very safe. I mean, overall, to fly, you know, any of the airplanes, I mean, statistically, it's, as I say, it's much, much safer than any place else. You brought up something else, though, about the pilots living in other places. I mean, that is routine in the industry, and while they're very regulated on the amount of time that they can spend, flying airplanes while they're actually working, there isn't a lot of attention spent to, you know, what they're doing with their personal life, for example. So, and I don't know that you can regulate that, but, you know, many pilots live far away. Many airline employees live far away from where they work. They've just gotten used to doing that over the years. Airline employees jump on airplanes the way that other people jump in taxi cabs and think nothing about, you know, living halfway across the country from where they normally fly. I don't know. That's a good point. I've never thought about that in terms of whether that would make things safer if we required that the pilot that was flying that plane lived in Buffalo or Newark or whatever, or close to there, to that city. But it's very, very, it's rampant in the industry, not just for pilots, but for a lot of airline employees to live in different places.
Yeah. All right, let's go to line one for another caller. Hello. Champagne. Hello. Yes.
One of the main concerns that I have today is with the regional jets is safety. And all you have to do is go back and listen to those recordings on the most recent flight that had the crash in Buffalo. And those pilots, they were not experienced. So safety becomes a real issue for me, quite frankly.
Yes.
What's your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, as I say, I think that, you know, statistically, you're right that the regional jets have had a higher accident rate. But again, you know, it's still so minuscule. It's so, you know, there's so many millions of flights that are flown without an incident that, again, you're far more likely to be killed on the highway or any other way of transportation than by air. Should we have more scrutiny, though, for the regional jets? I think perhaps that, you know, is surfacing, and maybe there will be more attention paid to that. Should the regional jet pilots have more training, have more experience? Perhaps that will, of course, raise the cost, the prices, and so forth. But, I'm not arguing against safety. But I do think that it's, statistically, millions of flights fly without any kind of incident. And they do have training. I mean, it's not like they don't get any training. It's just that, you know, when you get to be the pilot of a 747 or another wide body aircraft, you've worked many, many years in that industry. So.
Well, I'm certainly not one of those persons that doesn't realize that it's safer to fly than it is to drive my automobile. But to me, that is not the issue. One major concern for me is the pilots and the training. Mm-hmm. And you just can't forego that and getting to safety, quite frankly.
Right, right. And I do agree. I think that having more experience is good, although I'll give you the other side of the argument, because I've heard pilots argue this as well. And I've heard pilots say that, you know, those people that have flown so much and are so, you know, for example, if you are flying a, if you're flying one of those regional jets that goes between Newark and Buffalo, you're making multiple, many takeoffs and landings every day, and that's the most difficult part of flying. Whereas if you are the most experienced captain of a 747 or a 777 or whatever, you're flying 10-hour flights or 12-hour flights, and you're only making, you know, one or two takeoffs and landings a day. And so there are those that argue that those people are more likely to become complacent or less, their skill sets are kind of not as sharp as those who are making lots and lots of takeoffs and landings. So I will give you that other side, although statistically, you're right, there has been, there definitely are more crashes per million than on the regional jets, the large jets.
We got to leave it there with our thanks to our guest, David Grossman. He writes the Business Traveler column for USA Today. You can see that in the paper. If you're interested in reading some of his previous columns, you can go to usatoday.com and see them there. And Mr. Grossman, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.